Hello and welcome to this week's TES podcast. I'm reporter Dave Speck, and joining me is the usual bunch of regulars. We've got reporter John Roberts. Hi, John.
Hello there.
Got reporter Amy Gibbons. Amy, hi.
Hey.
Got deputy news editor Mary Louise Clues. Mary Louise, hello.
Hi there.
We've got news editor Will Stewart. Hi, Will.
Hello.
Now, first week back, we've got through it, but how did it go? Anyone spoken to any teachers' heads this week about any testimonies?
Yeah, I've chatted to a couple of people about how things have gone, you know, in the first week back. Obviously, we knew there was going to be a lot of stuff to get through. And I think one of the bits of feedback that I've had has been that has just put a huge demand on staff. So, and specifically the testing. As it's been rolled out. So we knew, I suppose, going into it, and we were being warned that was going to be a logistical challenge for schools. And that is the feedback that I've had, really. Demand on staff has been huge. There was, you know, some mention of maybe some problems with the website. I'm not sure if that was, you know, about reporting testing. I'm not sure if that was widespread or whether that was an isolated case.
Well, just let me pick you up on that testing, because that's been a big story for us this week, that, you know, when the government said initially that students testing positive on a lateral flow device at home should stay off school for 10 days, even if a subsequent PCR test, which is more accurate, came back negative.
And yeah,
you did that, didn't you, Amy? There was some confusion there, wasn't there? Because didn't they change their minds or something on that?
I mean, the system with all the various different types of tests is confusing enough in itself, isn't it? But yeah, so there was a lot of confusion on the day. A children's minister, Vicky Ford, she came out in the morning speaking on the radio, and she was saying that children who test positive for COVID with a lateral flow test, so that's one of those rapid tests, at home, and then subsequently receive a negative PCR test result, so that's the test that takes slightly longer to come back but is also widely regarded as being more accurate, should actually just not return to class, you know, should continue to isolate, even though that subsequent test may come back negative. And that kind of sparked a bit of confusion, especially among school teachers and leaders, sort of saying, why would somebody who, you know, a more accurate test...
It sounded illogical, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, need to kind of stay off. And so there was a bit of a backlash about that. And actually, 10 Downing Street came out subsequently and cleared that all up for us. So now, yes, if you're at home when you take your rapid test, then you will actually be given a follow-up PCR test. And if that's negative, then you'll be able to go back to school. So that has now been cleared up. But I must say, it probably wasn't particularly helpful having that extra stress and confusion when we've already got an awful lot of stuff to be getting on with in the first week back.
Because there was Will, and this is probably one for you, there was quite a lot, there was a statistic that something like 250,000 students could have been forced to self-isolate unnecessarily. Is that right?
Yeah, this is where it is complicated, because you've not just got two different types of tests, you've also got two sets of rules for how these tests should stand. So as Amy's just gone over what's supposed to happen at home, but the DfE in their wisdom have said there should be a different set of rules for what should happen at schools. So if you get a positive lateral flow test in school, then they're saying that should stand no matter what. Even if you get a PCR test, the so-called gold standard of testing, even if that then says you're negative, you should still be told to go home and self-isolate, which has left people really... really confused about why that would happen. And the suggestion that there is some logic behind it, which is that they're making the distinction between school and home because they think some of the problems at home will happen because lateral flow tests are not being administered properly. So they're saying, well, you'll solve those problems because they'll be overseen in school. But what critics are pointing out is that the accuracy, the inaccuracy of lateral flow tests is not just about that. It's also in the tests themselves. So people have been pointing to the fact that I should have this off the top of my head, but I think it might be there's 1 in 1,000. Apologies if that stat is wrong, but there's a stat for how many lateral flow tests produce false positives.
That's right.
Brilliant. Thanks, Amy. And then on the basis of that, the Association of School and College Leaders has said, if you carry on with this, have extrapolated that you'll have 250,000 children sent home unnecessarily. they warn that, and in the same day that they warn that, we had examples, and more have come to light since. There was a doctor, I think from a medical doctor in Oxford, who tweeted because she was furious because her son and 30 other pupils had self-isolated, even though they'd had negative PCR tests. So, yeah, it's obviously a bit of a problem there, and it could pick up as term goes on, I think.
Because there was that story that you did at the start of the week about this, Amy, this is the strange lack of positives from school COVID tests, and this is of the vulnerable and key worker children.
Yeah, so this was actually a little bit later. So we had that kind of confusion about lateral flow and follow-up PCR tests and you know, when you can and can't return to school. And then there was some interesting stuff that came out that Will mentioned about the kind of false positivity rate of these tests. And that statistic was used by the Department of Health and Social Care to sort of say, you know, these tests have got a very low false positivity rate, you know, at 1 in 1,000, so we don't need to worry about it too much. But actually, separately, there's an expert in biostatistics from the University of Birmingham, a guy called Professor John Deeks, and he actually spoke in a little bit more detail about why it may, you know, we may have evidence to indicate that a lot of the positive results that we're getting from these rapid tests are actually false. And he kind of used the statistics that we got from last week on rapid tests to kind of argue this. So he said of the 300,000 children tested using lateral flow tests last week, just 189 were actually found to be positive for COVID-19. And then he cited this rate of, you know, 1 in 1,000 tests are actually false positives. So he used that to argue that actually then maybe of those 189 tests that came back positive, a lot of them, judging by that rate, are likely to be false positives. So are we looking at a situation where a great deal of our tests that are coming back, rapid flow tests coming back positive, are actually not accurate, and students may well be isolating when they don't need to? So it's an interesting discussion, and it's quite complicated, but ultimately I think there is some dispute, you know, there's some debate about whether these tests have got, you know, a low false positivity rate or not, and what that might mean for kind of what we're asking students and teachers to do when they get a positive result. So Yeah, sorry, go on, Dave.
No, I'm just going to say, anyone who is confused by these stories, it is on the website if it helps you to read, you know, read things rather than hear them. But I'll cut you off, Amy. I probably shouldn't have done it. Sorry, what were you going to say?
All I was going to say, I think, is that it kind of raises the question about when we use rapid tests and when it's useful actually to use those PCR tests. And we know the government has said that they'll encourage, you know, follow-up PCR tests at home. Why they haven't done that when tests have taken place in schools is unclear, because it may be that teachers and staff can carry them out more accurately or go through the process at schools in a way that, you know, they think is quite secure, and they'll get, you know, the best result they can. But the tests themselves, as Will was saying, they're not more accurate than PCRs, so no way of carrying them out is going to make them more accurate, if that makes sense.
It's a difficult one to defend, isn't it? Because it sounds like quite an easy one to solve. Although I don't understand why they don't just say, yes, you know, if you take a PCR test, then that trumps the lateral flow. And I can't really see any motivation from, maybe they feel that their whole rapid testing policy is kind of under attack, so there's a bit of kind of siege mentality, and we kind of stick to it. But it seems a little short-sighted.
Yeah, I wondered about that. I wonder whether they don't want to, you know, if they did that, it's almost an admission that the lateral flow test is a kind of a much less effective test, and therefore the results just come with, every result comes with an asterisk, and they don't want to have to kind of have something which is effectively the bottom brick of their supposed safe return to schools, to have to kind of admit, well, actually there is a much more robust version of testing, so once you've got that, forget this test that we're putting this great stock in.
Well, I don't even think they need to be that cautious, because, you know, talking about what the feeling, you know, you were saying, Dave, to start with, what the general mood about going back to school is this week. And what I'm getting is, it's not people, teachers just feel that want to get on with it, don't they? I'm not sensing a huge amount of, oh, you know, we shouldn't be in here. It's like people are getting down to it. So I think it's just feels like teachers just want to get a way that works and isn't going to have, you know, huge chunks of classes missing school unnecessarily.
I mean, one silver lining of the situation as well with the idea of the follow-up PCRs is that we've only got each student needs to take 3 tests on site, and then after that we are moving to twice weekly home testing where these PCRs will be given for positives. So at least, you know, this issue with not taking the follow-up test after a school rapid test, you know, will shortly be over. But it does raise the question of why they didn't kind of implement that in the first place.
Well, let's move on, because another area of school life which is massively different is that now pupils are having to wear masks in secondary schools, at least. And that's created huge problems this week. And we saw the ASCL president, Richard Sheriff, speaking to reporters yesterday, didn't we? And he was talking about some of the problems that teachers are facing, that, you know, it's difficult to gauge the mood of a class when all you can see is their eyes. You can't see if they're worried or anxious or, you know, and he says it doesn't help teachers. And then he went on to sort of say that, you know, there are those of us that question whether mask wearing does in fact make things safer in schools, given that, you know, these wet, soggy masks are worn all day long, they've been touched repeatedly, and at the end of the school day you shove it in your pocket and then you don't even bother to wash it when you get home. It, you know, and he says, and his quote was something like, well, I would ask the chief medical officer, Professor Chris Whitsey, that question, because that's not one I can answer, he says. And I think it's a valid point, because, you know, it all seems quite futile if you know, if you're going to wear a mask, you're going to wear it properly, haven't you? I mean, I can kind of see what he's saying, but
doesn't it come down to something's better than nothing? Yeah. You know what I mean? Just because it's not perfect, and just because some students might not be wearing them properly, isn't it? Even if some of them aren't, you're going to get some protection. I mean, I can see all the problems with teaching and how difficult that will make it. But I guess that's what a lot of teachers will put back to that who have concerns about their safety, that it might not be perfect, but you know, something's better.
Well, no, one of the other things we picked up was the fact that teachers just can't hear pupils. There's been quite a few teachers saying that, you know, they feel that they're going deaf. And it must be incredibly frustrating, difficult to teach something like French or English. You know, maths would be easier possibly, because you know you could use whiteboards, get pupils to hold up the answers. I don't know, but I mean, I just really feel for the teachers' schools this week in particular. Must be enormously difficult.
I think that's why we saw a lot of resistance earlier when there were calls for masks in classrooms, actually from the department itself, saying, you know, they do impede teaching, they get in the way, you know, it can be stressful for, especially for younger children. I know the younger children don't have to wear them at the moment, it's the secondary school children, but yeah, so it is, I think it's something they've acknowledged in the past, but maybe as Will says, I mean, I think I'm inclined to agree. If you ask everybody to do it, then you hope that it will have some kind of positive effect, even if not everyone's doing it perfectly. I don't think it's one of these things where if one person doesn't wear it perfectly, it ruins it for everybody. But I suppose it depends who's infected and who they come into contact with.
Well, look, the Education Secretary, Gavin Williamson, was speaking on the first day of the ASCL conference this morning. And Amy and John, you tuned in and you got out some stories pretty quickly. I know one of them was that he said he's sticking with GCSEs. Another one that was that the catch-up cash we've already had was only the tip of the iceberg. But Mary Louise, you also watched this as well, didn't you? How did he come across, do you think? What did you make of it?
He was striking a conciliatory tone. There was a lot of thanking of teachers and recognition of the hard work that's gone on through the pandemic. I think that really stuck out. As you mentioned, in terms of news, there wasn't really anything. There wasn't any major announcements. Sometimes ministers use these speeches to make big policy announcements, and there wasn't that today. Although he did, there was a hint at perhaps that he might be lobbying the Treasury, is already lobbying the Treasury for more money when he said that the money that's already been announced will only scratch the surface in terms of, I think it's 1.7 billion, will only scratch the surface in terms of catch up post-COVID. And there was also, the comment about GCSEs, which is obviously backing up something that Nick Gibb said earlier in the week about GCSEs continuing to be the gold standard for age 16 assessment. So that was sort of overall my thoughts. What was your impressions, Amy and John?
I did the story about how he said that the catch-up funding only really scratches the surface of what is needed, and with kind of the commentary surrounding that, I really thought it was channeling Sir Kevin Collins. I mean, I interviewed Kevin a couple of weeks ago and did quite a few stories about what he said, and the soundbites that I was hearing from Sir Kevin were being echoed in what Gavin Williamson was saying. So I think whatever he's saying, it is feeding through. I mean, this idea of, as well, of helping children to develop sort of spiritually and emotionally through things like sports and arts, as well as traditionally academic subjects, developing their intellects. So I thought that was interesting. And many, I suppose, will be happy who liked Sir Kevin's ideas that they do appear to be feeding through. I don't know about you, John, you did the GCSEs one, didn't you?
Yes. The thing he said about GCSEs, I suppose, is it's significant because he said it, and he said it quite emphatically, but it's probably what, you know, it would have been very surprising if he'd come out differently. I think the thing probably struck me most about it wasn't actually Gavin Williamson, but was the way Askell handled him. So Richard Sheriff was doing the Q&A afterwards, and it was quite a kind of gentle, conversational, collegiate sort of thing. It struck me that, you know, if this event had been taking place in December or January, the tone might have been a lot different. You kind of got the sense that the profession's been increasingly angry and exasperated. Whereas today it seemed very much like we've gone through this awful period together, and a lot of the questions are about what's going to happen next and what are your plans for the future. And yeah, so it seemed that's the thing that struck me most, was that it seemed almost perhaps as if, I don't know whether the anger has dissipated or whether the profession's just really seeking answers and clarity about what happens next. But it didn't seem to be the event that I think you might have expected, given his standing with the profession.
I think sometimes they're like, because I can't even remember if it was Gavin Williamson, but certainly secretaries of state have been ambushed at head conferences before and have got a terrible going over. I'm sure I remember one when Jeff Barton was there and was trying to. Yeah, my memory's terrible. Whether it was Gavin Williamson or Damien Hines, but he was trying to be conciliatory, but his members just didn't want it, and I guess that can play badly. You know, it might feel good for the membership, but I guess they might be concerned that it might play badly publicly. Although Gavin Williamson isn't terribly popular in the country, but also if you're trying to do what heads associations tend to try and do, which is influence through lobbying, I guess that maybe they were trying to play the long game a bit. I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose as well, the other thing is it's a conference on Zoom, isn't it? So I saw the stage, but I didn't necessarily see 1,000 head teachers screaming into their laptops. So that was definitely the thing that struck me about it, that it was quite kind of positive and constructive. It wasn't kind of we've got this problem and that problem and what are you doing about it. It was very much kind of taking a long view and asking for his vision.
John, if I can just say, I thought it was very good timing your exclusives on Academy Boss Pay today, given that it's the start of the Askell conference. Can you just talk us through some of your top lines? Strong stuff.
Yeah, so we've been going through multi-academy trust annual accounts, which have been coming out since the start of the year. They seem to have been a little bit more delayed this year, perhaps because of the COVID situation. And we've had a particular focus on what some of the biggest trusts are paying and also what some of the highest salaries are. And one of the things we pulled out in the story on our site today is that there are now 7 people in the state school sector earning more than £250,000, which is up a couple on the previous year, which is quite a striking figure. And had some comments from Mary Bastard about the fact that there's kind of an increasing picture of pay differential in the sector and the government can't even think about it or doesn't have the levers to change that. The highest salary, as has been well established, is Sir Dan Moynihan in Chief Executive of the Harris Federation, which is sort of out of kilter really with others, in excess of 400,000. And they have the two highest paid employees in the state school sector in the country. We also produced a big table of all of the maps, all of the major maps that we've seen. So we looked at schools that trusts that run more than 20 schools to see what they're paying. And there's a real variety there, both in terms of the salaries, but also whether or not increases have happened. So some major trusts, including AET and ARC, have actually seen their senior leaders getting less this year than last year. But it's there on our site, but it's really interesting to see the spread of salaries, if you like, organisations of a similar size doing things differently. So there's not a... And when we look at the top seven earners, in that you've got a leader of a multi-academy trust that runs 90 schools, all the way down to a head teacher of a single school in Kensington. So it's a big pay isn't just in one type of setting. It's really interesting to kind of break it down.
I thought the Harris stuff was interesting, just looking at the figures there, because one of the other things you looked at, John, was the number of employees in that trust that were getting paid more than 100,000, and it had gone up by 25% in a single year, which I mean, on the one hand, we did a story earlier this week or last week about, I think it was 40 teachers in Eton being paid £100,000. So I guess the Harris thing is slightly different because they're probably heads, but it just seems like a big leap in a year. I mean, maybe it was just accidental because of where the pay brackets fell, but that...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was gone up from like 31 to 40 something. I think there was a slight reduction in the bracket below. So it might just have been, as you say, that there was a lot of people on the cusp that kind of went over. But yeah, and I think it's a question really about... one thing that struck me doing it was, you know, think about what school pay looked like in 2011. And now this is what it looks like in 2021. You know, the individual schools and trusts might think they have a case in each and every case, but it just got me thinking that what might this look like in 2031? This is public money, and it's gone in a direction where it almost doesn't look like public sector pay in some organisations. And yeah, it'd be interesting to see how it continues to track.
That's what happens, isn't it? Because it's classic executive pay. It's where, because you've got ordinary, because that's the real contrast. You've got teachers pay, you know, teachers everywhere are now contemplating the pay freeze. And I think last year they got 2.75. So that's very tightly controlled, just like the NHS, which has been all over the news. But then for the kind of executive pay, there's a kind of different what's current pulling it upwards, really, isn't it? It's not a pay review body. It's everybody else looking at, you know, do we value our leader enough? You know, might we lose them? And I think that's what sometimes, maybe less so since the departments intervened, but certainly previously, trust, I think it was that classic executive thing with almost like a company looking at everybody else and that kind of inflationary pressure picking it up. So it's almost like there's two different worlds of teacher pay going on, I think, in that respect.
Well, I asked Sir Dan Moynihan, I asked him directly at the Schools and Academies show in Birmingham a couple of years ago. I went up and said, you know, how can you justify this salary? I don't know if you remember that, Will and John.
Yeah, yeah.
But he just said, you know, what matters is the outcome for kids. And he says, we're managing our budgets effectively. The kids are getting a good deal. And then he said, you've got to look at the large salaries where it's only one or two schools. You know, it's very different where you've got a large number of schools and where the trust is doing well and where disadvantaged kids are making progress. But
I suppose that's the other thing I should say within the sector is that some of these trusts are growing. So the rationale could be, you know, we're making a big difference to life chances and we've taken on X many more schools this year. So we've hit our targets. So I think that's the rationale. You know, they're not necessarily standing still as trusts, but it's as Will says, it's out of kilter with what happens as well.
Sorry. I've always thought that argument's a little weak because it kind of goes, oh, you know, if you take on another 10 schools, then you should be worth this much more. And it's not like every 10 schools you take on, you're like, you know, you're managing those 10 schools. Yeah. You've got a head teacher for all those 10 schools. And presumably in somewhere big as Harris, I don't know this, but I'm surmising from looking at their pay, there must be other people, you know, in between heads and the CEO. Or if they're not, that's a head teacher getting paid £300,000. So,
yeah. Well, John, can I just stick with you? Because I want to just ask you about your exclusive from last night about Amanda Spielman, the... Chief Inspector of Schools. She wants more time, doesn't she, to carry on?
Yes, that's the story we broke last night. Yeah. So this is something I've been looking at for a wee while. Basically, her term is due to run out this year, and she introduced a new inspection framework 2 years ago, September 2019, so not even 2 years ago. It got less than two terms before the COVID crisis sort of struck and inspection was put on hold and hasn't really had any time to bed in. And I think it kind of had a mixed landing. I think it's probably fair to say some people liked it, some people didn't. And obviously COVID has just taken over and a year has gone by and there's still no sort of guarantee about what happens next with Ofsted. And we understand that she's likely to ask for her term to be extended, not that she wants to serve another full 5 years, but the, I think she wants more time to kind of have time to see the framework bed in. And I think there's a sense that if that didn't happen and Ofsted, she left in December and a new chief inspector came in, they might want to put their own stamp on the organisation, particularly given the fact that the education landscape's been transformed by COVID. And if they brought a new framework in, potentially things that Ofsted had, under its current leadership had hoped would be transformative and change the way school inspection was done permanently could just be a transient thing that was done for a time and then replaced. So I think she
framework
wants to...
obsolete now. I mean, is this framework, this new framework obsolete now? Because, I mean, people like Kate Green are calling for a huge change in the role of Ofsted. It needs to be more hand-holding and more cuddly and support.
Big debate, isn't it? It's the other thing we revealed last week was that that Ofsted, because Ofsted had planned to go back to normal in January to start with, and then that got pushed back to after Easter, and now that's been changed, and they said that they're just in discussion with government about what their future inspections are going to look like and what the timings will be. So yeah, I think there's it seems to me in a way that there's, looking from the outside, it seems to me that Ofsted have been keen to get back to some version of normality in terms of the way inspection is done. They were pushing, you know, they set a January date and then an April date, and now it's up in the air. And I get the sense from what we've heard is that they'd like more time to try and embed their framework more. But as you say, there's a big debate about what inspection should look like and what the sector needs, given the impact of COVID. Yeah, absolutely.
Look, I'll tell you what, we're running out of time. So can I just ask you, Mary Louise, about beanie hats, if I may?
Absolutely. Well, this is this is a really nice story that's broke this week that sort of did really well on social media, unsurprisingly. There's a primary school called North Ormsby Primary School or Primary Academy in Middlesbrough, where they've got this particularly special teaching assistant, it seems, called Chris Dowie, who sort of made an offhand promise to a year six people that she would who was commenting on a Shrek beanie hat that she'd crocheted, and saying, "Oh, I'll make one for everyone when lockdown lifts." And then the announcement was made about lockdown lifting, schools returning. So she spent 70 hours crocheting, watching the West Wing. I think she watched four series or something of box sets of the West Wing, getting these Shrek beanie hats made for the year six, I think it was 30 year six pupils. And there's pictures of them in the story on our website, across social media. They look really, really sweet. They look absolutely delighted. I'd be quite delighted. And I've since heard, by the way, that they have been invited. There's a Shrek experience, and because this took off on social media, there's a Shrek experience run by Merlin. Wow. And they've invited the entire class to go and visit, apparently, after when lockdown lifts as well. So, excellent. Smiles all round.
Well, look, thanks for listening. See you soon, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.